For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. Gentlemen, the political season is well underway.
Oh boy, is it ever.
And one of the subjects that always comes up when we're discussing, you know, the political theories and everything else that's going on out there is, well, the opposition is being unethical in this aspect. Mm. What are ethics and, you know, how do they apply to everyday life? And, you know, is there just one set of ethics? Is there multiple sets of ethics? Or, you know, what do we mean when we throw that term out that someone is being unethical?
Well, ethics is a branch of philosophy. Philosophy, of course, means the love of wisdom. And ethics tries to get at or offer a system and answer to the question, you know, how ought I to live my life? What should I aim at?
Right. How should I conduct myself? And, you know, traditionally, it's actually a branch of politics, or politics is an offshoot of ethics. So, you know, our ethical behavior, how we conduct ourselves in our personal lives, that's supposed to telescope out and incorporate how others ought to live and how we ought to live as a society and then how we ought to live as a nation. And that, you know, then dovetails into politics.
Yeah, our laws and social norms and customs and tradition ought to reflect the values, generally speaking, of what the individuals hold in common.
Right. And, you know, Kent brings up a great question, because when somebody accuses somebody of being unethical, right now in today's day and age, it's hard to pinpoint a particular ethical system that is accepted.
That everybody that has a consensus, right?
That everybody agrees to say, okay, yeah, this activity is ethical, this activity is unethical. So, I mean, in the world of politics, I think it's pretty cut and dry. You're breaking the rules. When you say somebody is acting unethically, they're either breaking the rules of Congress, they're breaking the rules of the legal profession, they're breaking the rules of somebody that they belong to, and therefore they're being accused of acting unethically, generally.
Yeah, I think that's probably about right, that there's a pointing to a there's a body of rules, whether it's the ones you mentioned, you know, civil or what have you, and then they're being violated at some point.
But it does bring up a question of which comes first, the rules and the laws and, you know, sort of what's been posited out there of how we should live, or how we should live, and then those rules and laws ought to reflect that. You know, which is driving which? The laws and rules that are published, are those driving ethics, or our ethical norms and standards and what we recognize and kind of all know deep down, well, this is the way we really ought to be doing things. Is that what's driving the rules and laws that we live by?
Well, you're going to hate this. I'm going to say it's a little bit of both. And and the reason why I say it's a little bit of both is there are a variety of different ethical systems and theories that we're going to talk about. The one, just by way of preview, the one I hold to is natural law theory. And natural law theory has kind of like a top-down, I would say it's kind of like a top-down approach where the highest laws or our highest good really is the eternal law. And then from that flows divine law through revelation. And then comes natural law, and then comes human law, laws that we as human beings make. So I would say that's sort of the structure. But then, of course, the reason why I say it's a little bit of both is that we're all born into a particular time and place, right? We're born into a particular setting, socioeconomic setting, and within that, the posited laws are teachers, and so we are brought we're brought up, we're raised, or we should be, to respect the law. And that if it's lawful, just generally speaking, if it's lawful, then it's, we tend to think that it's good and permissible and you can do it. And if it's illegal or unlawful, then you break, then that's a bad thing, and there are consequences come with it. So it's a little bit of both. I would say the fundamental structure, though, is that relationship between eternal, divine, natural, human law in that order, in that hierarchy. But then we grow up in a setting in which the posited laws, the civil and criminal code, act as a kind of teacher.
That all seems very idealistic to me, Tim, because I think when you take an ordinary average person that's out there, they're not that reflective on what they're doing. They're not positing, when I'm waking up and I'm getting my breakfast and I'm getting ready to go to work, and there's a whole set of ethical decisions, believe it or not, that fall into that. You know, am I gonna grab the super cocoa puff, sugar loaded cereal?
Yes. Or with coffee.
Yeah. Or
to jumpstart your day.
Yeah. Or am I gonna get my granola, right?
That's squirrel food, buddy. You don't wanna do that.
Exactly. So I don't think we reflect on, natural law as such. Our decisions that we make, the way we live, our actual ethical lives are governed more by traditions. They're governed more by, this is an old term, and unfortunately it's coming into disrepute in contemporary settings, but prejudices. Not judging somebody else, but doing something just because it's the way it's always been done.
I might even say habit then.
Habit, right, yeah. Right, exactly. So those tend to be, in my mind, the way most people conduct their lives, and really what gives most people their moral norms. The ways that they were brought up, it gets expressed as just simply, in our household, we don't do it that way. It's not a really reflective thing, but it's been handed down by tradition, and that's not to mean it's against natural law. That doesn't mean it doesn't comport with natural law. I would guess probably 9 times out of 10, if you've got a conflict between one of those ways that are handed down and what somebody disagrees with that thinking is based on natural law, that it's probably the custom and habit that actually is, and the person's probably wrong. But those tend to be the way that we make moral judgments, and not necessarily reflecting off of, okay, well, this is what I know is natural law. This is what I know is divine law. And so therefore this is the way I ought to act.
Well, I would agree. I would agree with that, we're not engaged in, throughout our day, in elaborate, detailed moral reasoning for each and every action and choice that we make. And most of that is worked out, as an adult at least, is worked out through the virtues or vices that we've acquired. But those virtues and vices, though, I would say, are grounded in things like, good laws. Again, human laws will point us towards things like, an alignment would be something like the prohibition to stealing. So there are civil and criminal penalties, prohibitions to stealing. But that also comports with the natural law. We also know that it comports with divine law, because there's we have the Decalogue, right? We have the Ten Commandments, and it's explicit in there. So when all those things align, so you're right. Every time I encounter someone else's property, I'm not pausing to work my way through the entire system. You see this in young children. They have to be habituated to respecting the property of others and asking permission before using it or unjustly possessing someone else's property. It's grounded in that, you don't have to go through elaborate moral reasoning at each step of the day.
Right. And even the way it's taught, it's not taught in such a way of, stealing something is illegal. Mom and dad might pull that out when you get to a certain age. Well, that's illegal. If you keep doing that, you're going to go to jail. But generally speaking, the way you're taught that is, that's not how we conduct things in our household. You know, we don't steal because we're not that type of people. And so it, the language and the way those are taught is, once again, not running through some sort of reasoned process, but it's based upon how we've always done things, how I was raised, what I've inherited from my past, and what I inherit from my community.
Yeah, well, I think there you're talking the language of Alistair McIntyre a lot.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and not so much intentionally, but you're right. Mm-hmm. I don't think McIntyre would disagree.
Right, and I think that stresses the importance of culture and the family setting, because not every family, though, out there, I can tell you, is one organized the way yours or mine is. And then it's not all being shared that way. There's a lot of different understanding about what it means to steal. So, for example, I recently encountered a young adult who was, you know, perfectly willing to share their point of view that stealing is completely permissible from large corporations, because large corporations are generally evil in their sight and have acquired their goods through illicit means. So they're gigantic. So there's a certain proportionality that if me, the individual, steals from a large corporation, it's a kind of reparation. And they're kind of getting what they deserve, and they can afford it, and they won't even miss it.
Right. You know, it brings to mind
So it makes you wonder how they right. were raised, or what's happened since then.
Exactly. Yeah. But it brings to mind one of my favorite, I think, ethical philosophers, Margaret Anscombe, and she said, you know, that all moral philosophers since the time of Sidgwick, so you know that would have been in the height of emotivism when that was going on. So
I think it's still going on, but
yeah, well that's true too. But anyway, since the 1920s or so, but all moral philosophers show signs of a deviant mind. And you know, your young student I think is a great example of that, because he came to that conclusion that it's okay to steal from large corporations through an elaborate process of moral reasoning. So he was applying the principles of moral reasoning. He was going through that process of trying to think through what was right and wrong to prove that what he had inherited, basically, the standard that everybody else follows, the standard that we've all inherited, he went through this elaborate moral reasoning to prove to himself that no, indeed, stealing in that situation is okay. And I think that's what you wind up with a lot of times when you start to engage in moral reasoning, is you wind up talking yourselves out of what truly is ethically correct and morally right.
And we need to take a break. We'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy right after this.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Alexa, what's the weather forecast for today?
Alexa, what time is the Colts game today?
Alexa, remind me to pick up the dry cleaning tomorrow.
Has Alexa become a part of your daily routine? Then make sure that routine includes Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Quick, easy access to Catholic programming 24/7. Just say, Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell in the cave. My trusty sidekick, Kent Blandford, I should say our, because Mark's here too, Mark Tuttle. And Mark, we were talking about ethics, and I had brought up an example in that first segment of someone I encountered who was expressing kind of their, at least a portion of their ethical system that included what I'm going to describe as, because it's the term they used, a kind of a Robin Hood ethical system. In other words, and I love the original Errol Flynn growing up. They used to have, I was in the Chicago area, so it was WGN Channel 9, and they had on Sundays a show hosted by Frazier Thomas called Family Classics. And then they would show, and this was like in the afternoon, and then they would show like classic movies, including Robin Hood with Errol Flynn, which was fantastic. So, and of course, the premise there is that Robin Hood is a good guy, And what he's doing is he robs from the rich to give to the poor. So this, the ethical system that was being justified was that they were acting as a kind of Robin Hood, that it's okay to steal from large corporations because you're not really, they're so large, the individual's really not harming them because they still got billions or trillions left. But it's sort of righting a wrong because they've gotten their assets through ill-gotten means anyway, through the unsubstantiated allegations of like exploiting workers, right? Not paying them a living wage and things, all sorts of, all those things you can imagine. But that was the Robin Hood syndrome. So that was, and that was part of, so they, in their sphere of thinking about the world, in their worldview on right and wrong, good and evil, they were acting in accord with core values that they had, that Robin Hood is a good kind of character, good role model, good archetype, and they were simply acting that out.
Yeah, and that's a process of moral reasoning. We all go through moral reasoning at some level. As I said, I really think our bottom line actions, what we base our lives around, are pre-rational. But at some point, we examine those. At some point, somebody comes up and questions the way we've always done things, or the way we've always done things isn't working out so well. And so we come to question those rules, those modes of living, and we begin to look at it. And there's a number of different schools of thought as to what is the best way to look at a set of practices and determine whether this is morally right and morally wrong. And your young student was engaging in probably one of the more common ways, especially in modern times, of utilitarianism, weighing out the end results, what's going to result from this action, and is that going to be a better situation than what is now? And so, based on the idea that, you shouldn't have huge differences in wealth between like a large corporation mm-hmm. and other people. And given that, the poor people tend to have greater needs than a larger corporation, therefore, the end result of somebody stealing from that large corporation is really going to be a better situation from everybody. The large corporation's not going to notice. They don't need the money, supposedly. And, the person who's receiving the money is going to be much better off. And so that money is going to be better suited in the hands of somebody who's going to be in a large corporation. But that's utilitarianism. That's looking at a situation and saying, what is going to be the best end result? And therefore the actions,
the greatest good for the greatest number.
Right, yeah. Right, exactly. What is, and yeah, there's a calculus based around mm-hmm. around good and happiness, and I guess there's varying disagreements among different philosophers on whether you should be measuring, happiness and have some sort of happiness quotient.
Is tricky.
Right. You should be measuring the results of the action some other way. But all of that is broadly speaking either utilitarianism or consequentialism, which is really mm-hmm. what Margaret Anscombe was.
Just don't ask me to sell it.
But she was really railing against that school of philosophy of looking at things based on
which
the
John Stuart Mill is the one who really gets the credit for developing it.
He wrote a very famous tract, Utilitarianism, where he laid it out.
Yeah, and utilitarianism, it simply is that thought of the greatest good or the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. And as being in a democracy, we can understand that system pretty well and even go along with it frequently, because we often, just in very common settings, ordinary settings, use things like majority rule to make the collective decision. So you're hanging out with, 10 of your friends and, some want to, what are we going to do Friday? Well, part of the group wants to do option A and the other part of the group wants to do option B. So how do you, you might just talk it through, or you might just do what? Well, let's have a show of hands. Who wants to do option A? Who wants to do option, and whoever gets the most hands, most votes, that's what we're going to do.
Right, because that's going to benefit the most people.
Correct.
You know, the easiest way. You know, the other thing I think that utilitarianism and democracy tend to go hand in hand is that you have to have sort of a common consensus on underlying values for utilitarianism really to work.
Right. You have to be part of a social contract, I would say.
Right, exactly. So you have to have a certain agreement that, okay, broadly speaking, social justice is a good that we all ought to be striving for. And so because of that, then you can judge your actions on what's going to lead to greater or lesser social justice based on, you know, your actions.
Yeah, I mean, I think citizenship is an example of a social contract that you're either born into or you can acquire. So when you become a naturalized citizen, let's say, you know, you're willingly there's a mutual agreement that now once you're sworn in, you now take on the you get the privileges, but you also get and rights, but you also get the duties and responsibilities that go along with being a citizen. And part of that of being a U.S. citizen is we have an electoral process that generally reflects the will of the people.
Right. And
the majority.
Yeah. But the problem with utilitarianism is what I call the 12-year-old boy effect.
Go ahead. 12 that could go a lot of ways.
12-year-old boys have the tendency and the ability to morally justify just about any set of actions that they want to do. If they want to do it, it is going to be morally justified somehow. And they're going to come up with reasons. They're going to come up with rationale of why this was a good idea. And 12-year-old boys are masters at this. They can justify just about the most egregious type of behavior you can imagine and come up with a argument for why this was right and why this was the right and just thing to do. And that's where utilitarianism really falls down because... As Catholic social teaching teaches, the ends don't justify the means. Mm-hmm. And there are all sorts of wicked ways that you can go about trying to come to good ends that just are morally wrong. And so no amount of coming up with a calculus of how to measure the benefits of these actions is going to justify these actions. You can't kill somebody for the benefit of society. That just doesn't work. I mean, unless it's a capital punishment type of situation, then maybe arguably.
You can't kill an innocent person on purpose directly as the means to achieving a good end.
Exactly.
I would agree with that.
Exactly. And so there are just certain things that you can't do. You can't justify them no matter what good may come of them.
Right. You can't, I think it summarized like you can't perform evil to accomplish a good. And so, yeah, so that's one of the failings of utilitarianism because it doesn't really it underplays or underemphasizes and subordinates the means, the how, to the primacy of the end or the thing that you're trying to accomplish, the good consequence you're trying to generate. We can't use, for example, we ought to be reluctant to use tissues from abortions that develop cell lines that produce, any type of, you know, therapeutic treatment that might be very helpful, even with it, variety of different really terrible diseases. But because the way you get to that therapy is through an illicit means, namely using, say, aborted tissue from aborted children. We can't partake in that.
Right. And so, you know, in addition to the end results, which is what utilitarianism is looking at, you also have to judge the actions that are getting there. And you have to have some way of determining whether those actions are right and wrong. And that's where some other ethical theories come in. I think the most common way of judging actions is looking at it through a lens of virtue ethics. Deciding is this action virtuous or is this action the opposite of virtuous, which would be vicious, vice filled. And so that's another way to get at moral truth by not looking so much at the consequences, but looking at the actions themselves and judging the actions, whether they're right or wrong.
Yeah, and the kind of character that you're building up as a result. And, you know, we know that there's... 4 cardinal virtues, 3 theological virtues. So the cardinal virtues are fortitude, prudence, justice and temperance. The theological virtues are faith, hope, and charity. And so it's in exercising those that one grows in virtue, the kind of virtues that we're talking about. Now, different thinkers over time have expressed different, like Aristotle, et cetera, Adam Smith even. There are plenty of thinkers along the way that they've, you know, sort of extrapolated more virtues or delineated them more. But those are the seven basic ones for Catholics.
Right. And then as those sort of branch off into more specific ones, you wind up with, you know, virtues that tend to be maybe community specific or cultural specific. Mm-hmm. And so you've got some variances there, culture to culture, that, you know, you might have some conflict then in the way it's different people do things and what priority they put on various virtues. So you wind up with some variety. But, you know, ethically speaking, I'm not sure that's a bad thing. You know, being able to learn from other people and being able to kind of check your own priorities based off of the priorities of others, I think is a good exercise in moral reasoning in and of itself.
Yeah, virtue theory and virtue ethics really, I think, takes advantage of the notion of an exemplar, of a, you know, prime role model. And for Catholics, guess what? We have many, 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 because we can turn to the saints with a capital S and look at the lives of the saints and use and imitate their virtues.
And with that, we're going to take a break. We'll be back with more of the Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy right after this. You know us as Catholic Radio Indy, but we're so much more than just radio. We're a voice for the church that's seldom heard in our chaotic world. We're confirmation for the strong of faith and encouragement and answers for those in doubt. We're there to rejoice with your triumphs and to be a voice of consolation through the dark times. We're a voice for vocations and proudly pro-life. We are Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm in the cave with Timothy O'Donnell.
Hey.
And Kent Blanford. I'm Mark Tuttle, and we are talking about ethics. We're talking about right and wrong. We're talking about the way we do things, the right way to do things, the wrong way to do things. And of course, since we're here in the cave, I'm sure we would be accused of doing all sorts of wrong things with the way we conduct ourselves, Tim. but we're talking about different ways of being able to judge the ethics of certain, I would say broadly speaking, certain ways and modes of doing things. We talked about utilitarianism, and that's really the art of judging the end results. And it's useful. Utilitarianism gets a bad name, particularly I think in Catholic circles, but especially in a democratic society that we live in, especially when there's a lot of consensus on values, on kind of everybody thinking the same way, generally speaking, about what a good life is, utilitarianism is a very useful way to come to an understanding of what might be wrong and what might be right. On the other hand, you know, it does not judge actions. And so you always run into the possibility that you are pursuing good ends, which a consequentialist or utilitarian view would say, yep, that's a good thing to go for. That's a good way to act. That's a good intention. But as they say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And so you have to have a way of judging actions. And so we were just talking about virtue ethics. And, you know, on the one hand, virtue ethics does sort of judge the actions, but really what virtue ethics is judging is exactly how you ended the last segment. It's judging the exemplars. Virtue ethics is based on the idea of good actions come from good people. And so if you want to know what the right thing to do is, you look towards a good person and figure out how they would have acted. So, the most recent, actually, it's not all that recent, but there was a while ago, the What Would Jesus Do movement. You know, they had little bracelets. WWJD written.
Right.
And that was really an attempt to get at virtue ethics, to think through the set of virtues that Jesus exemplified in his life and to pattern our lives off of how Jesus would work,
right.
Which is certainly not a bad way to decide what's right and wrong.
Right. Yeah. That's a great example of pulling in, you know, the thought of role models for us. And we like to, and it's difficult in the current setting to find good role models in the popular culture. So it's hard when where do we tend to look? Well, we tend to look towards, say, the entertainment industry. Well, that's very difficult to find good role models there. So again, it's Catholics turning to the saints with the capital S is, and studying the lives of the saints give us plenty of really excellent examples of people who live lives of virtue and holiness for us to imitate.
Right. And when you compare different moral ways of thinking about things, you wind up with different modes of moral education. Mm-hmm. For instance, if you think the best way to decide what's right and wrong is some sort of consequentialism, some sort of way of identifying what the end results of my action are going to be, then what you need is good training in all sorts of really sciences. You need to know economics. You need to know political science. You need to know natural science to a lesser extent. Most importantly, you need to know logic so that you can logically connect, how things are connected and what's going to follow from what necessarily through a logical process so that you can kind of find all of those little hidden. That's another problem with consequentialism is there's always unintended consequences.
Right.
But those unintended consequences, you really ought to be able to predict those as well as possible. So if you're going to follow a consequentialist viewpoint of trying to determine what's right and wrong, you need a broad-based education that hits on a lot of different fields to be able to decide what is going to be the best and the most good for the most amount of people. If you're looking at things virtue-based, you need a character-based education that is full of, as you said, role models. So your studies need to be of history. They need to be of literature. They need to be looking at human characters over and over again and getting exposure to as many different characters so that you can judge, well, this person was a good person, this person was a bad person, this person was somewhere in between, and the reason they were somewhere in between is because although they were courageous, they weren't necessarily prudent, and so they were able to exhibit the virtue of courage, but maybe not in the most prudent way. And so through exposure to literature and history and a broad humanities type of education, you develop a good moral education. And I would say, you need both. You really do need both sides of that education to be able to have a good moral outlook on the world.
Yeah, I would agree. That's why programs like The Great Books are so helpful. So let's advance the conversation. So we've talked a little bit about natural law. We've talked a little bit about utilitarianism. We've talked a little bit about consequentialism, which is sort of its twin sister, if you will. But let's move into another thinker, like Immanuel Kant.
Oh yes, Immanuel Kant, one of the brilliant philosophers out there. So when you look at virtue theory, which is to a great extent the moral outlook that Kant was sort of inheriting, the big flaw that you get to pretty quickly is relativism. If you are basing your things off of exemplars and you're basing your moral judgments off of the way good people act, you can have quite a bit of disagreement on who a good person is. And you run into a situation where there are no moral absolutes. When you're basing things off of courage and prudence and justice, the idea of strict rules to govern how I ought to live, well, how I ought to act in a particular circumstance, according to virtue ethics, is based on prudence. So it's based on another virtue. So you can get a little circular of saying, well, good virtue is based on good virtue, which is based on good virtue. And you never get to any sort of concrete grounding for how we ought to act. And that's kind of what Kant inherited. And among other things, he also inherited a very loosey-goosey skepticism that was so radical that it was willing to doubt even the foundations of how we go about thinking of things or how we can trust our sense perception. So out of that, Kant basically said, what is right and wrong needs to be based on universal principles of reason. And to get to something that is based on universal principles of reason, what are the two things you need? You need universality and you need reasonableness, right? So,
okay, well, there you go.
And so Kant came up with basically the idea that the groundwork for all of our human actions need to be based on pure reason, and that pure reason can best be expressed, and there's lots of different ways to express this, but it can best be expressed by a rule that can be universalized for all humanity. So if you have a rule and you have a conduct and an action, if you can universalize this and say, you know, for any person in any given place, in any given time, this is going to be the right thing to do, you can say that's a just action. If you say, well, you know what, this would turn to evil pretty quickly if certain people did this in certain situations, then that's not a good rule. So stealing is a perfect example. You might be able to justify stealing some of the time, but you certainly cannot imagine a universe where it works, where humanity is able to get along if stealing is universally allowed. Anybody at any given time in any given place is allowed to steal. Society would fall apart, and you quickly see that and you quickly realize that. So therefore, thou shalt not steal quickly becomes a universalized rule that's based on reason that can allow us to conduct ourselves in, you know, according to right or wrong.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary of Kant's system. His system sometimes called deontological or deontology. And it is a rules based system, and it is what you're talking about. I think is termed his categorical imperative.
Right.
Right. And that is universal, like you said, meaning it applies to everyone. There's no exceptions. Right. Everyone needs to follow these rules, and the rule, and that the summary of the rule, as you pointed out, is, you know, act in such a way that you would will or want anyone else in the same circumstance, same situation, to act in the same way. So it sort of eliminates, it's kind of a play off the golden rule, but it's the golden rule is treat other people the way you want to be treated, but the categorical imperative is act in such a way that you would want anybody else in your circumstances to act. So if you don't want you ought not to steal because you don't want to be stolen from.
Right, right. You know. And very shorthand Kant, very, very shorthand Kant. Your understanding of God, if you understand God as eminently reasonable, that God himself is reason itself. God is truth. God is truth, beauty, and goodness. If God is truth, God is reason, therefore what is good, the good is convertible with the truth. Mm-hmm. So therefore the good is convertible with reason itself. And so that which is good is that which is imminently and totally and completely, utterly reasonable. And that which is bad, and this is an insight that Augustine had, that which is bad is imminently irrational. And so a bad action is ultimately going to break down into irrationality. You are eventually going to find a fault that where reason breaks down when you look at something that is wrong. If you're looking at correct actions, reason is going to uphold that action all the way up. And no matter how you look at it and how many different angles you look at it and how many different circumstances you put that action in, it will always hold up to the scrutiny of reason, because ultimately truth and reason are convertible. So you've got the good, the true, and the beautiful as the three transcendentals. And because true and the truth and the reason are convertible, therefore our moral laws are ultimately completely 100%, and I would even go say so far as a religious person to say super rational, because they're based on the thought of God.
Yeah, that brings up something that made me think of the, so I think Kant, going to Kant's historical setting. He's in the 18th century and Prussian, and he's very much a product of the Enlightenment with its, I would say, hyper-focus on the capacity of reason. So when he writes his book, Critique of Pure Reason, you're right. I think what he's trying to say, hey, look, there's all these different, because there's a big rivalry between that had often erupted into violence between, say, Lutherans and Catholics. And so he wants to set aside religion and locate morality simply in the capacity of pure reason. And so after the break that's coming up here, well, I want to pick that back up because I want to show that there's a bit of a flaw in that project.
And we'll pick up with that right after this. This is the Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you been married and have since divorced? Do you think your marital status prevents you from coming to church? Most Catholics and non-Catholics unfortunately have a lot of misconceptions about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. Pope Francis has recently encouraged all people with questions about marriage to make an appointment and talk with their parish priest. As Catholic priests, we look forward to the opportunity to help you on your journey through life. Please make an appointment to speak with the priest today. We are and will always be here for you.
At Catholic Radio, we love to hear from you. Call us anytime. Just recently, we found this message on our voicemail.
I'm a non-Catholic that listens to your Catholic radio station, and I just wanted to thank you guys. I listen to Catholic Answers and Al Cresta sometimes, and I think her name's Teresa Tommy. I listen to her and another show or two. I appreciate it.
Call us at 317-870-8400 and let us know what you're thinking.
I just called to say, even though I'm not a Catholic, I listen to your station.
Where do you go for reliable information on what's happening in the world? Where can you turn for rock-solid teaching backed by centuries of unchanging, undeniable truth? Look first to the Catholic Church, and then be sure to tune in right here to Catholic Radio Indy. We are your source for 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Catholic Radio Indy and CatholicRadioIndy.org.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell, and in the cave still, Mark Tuttle and Kent Blanford. We've been looking at different ethical systems, and at the end of the last segment, we were talking about Immanuel Kant, his Critique of Pure Reason, and I suggested that there would be a flaw in his approach. And I would say in his system. So his system's called deontology. And it basically relies on what he expressed as the categorical imperative, which is it's a universal, meaning it applies to everyone. There's no person or group that has an exception to it. But to will that one act or in such a way that you'd have others act in the same way in the same circumstances. So it's kind of appeal to the best. To what's the best thing you can do, because that's what you would want or hope or expect from anyone else in the same situation. You want them to do the best or the best right thing. But here's the fly in the ointment, I think, with that system is it goes back to something I read from John Henry Cardinal Newman, which is that reason can go wild. Reason can go wild. In other words, there's a lot of, and Mark, you know this very well, and our listeners do too, You can pull up all kinds of even especially contemporary philosophers who are really smart men and women who have gotten things completely wrong, you know. and let me give you an example of one who's very, very consistent. He's brilliant in a lot of ways. Peter Singer. So he's a eminent philosopher out of Princeton. But he arrives at all, and he's not religious. He arrives at all sorts of really, I would say, morally repugnant conclusions like abortion and infanticide and things like, and putting animals on the same moral footing as human beings. I mean, he's just got a lot of stuff that goes wrong, but he's very consistent. He's very articulate in terms of his speaking his lectures, his books, and things like that. But what Cardinal Newman was pointing, St. John Henry Cardinal Newman pointed out, is that reason can go wild, and so we need divine revelation to put up the guardrails. And this is where Fides et Ratio, for example, Faith and Reason, that encyclical by St. John Paul the Great, discusses in great depth and beauty that relationship between faith and reason, because you really need both.
Right. And I certainly don't disagree with that at all. Peter Singer, just to defend my man Kant a little bit, Peter Singer's an avowed consequentialist and utilitarian. And I mean, I think his biggest moral mistake is he dismisses Kant out of hand. So,
right.
But no, reason is a tricky thing, and we are fallen creatures, and we do not have perfect reasoning ability. And this is going to apply, I think, to any ethical system.
Doesn't apply to natural law.
Well, it does to a certain extent.
We'll disagree on that. Because we won't have enough time to undo that one, though. That might be a fight for another day, my friend.
Because man is not perfectly able to rationally know the thoughts of God, and that's going to apply to,
certainly not exhaustively, but we can know some,
but we're also prone to error.
So the same proneness to error,
reason can go wild, whether you're mm-hmm. trying to figure out natural law or whether you're trying to figure out some sort of deontological system. And so when you apply reason, I think you have to have the humility to recognize that I, as an individual, am not going to be able to figure this out. And I think that's where a more conservative approach to ethics, where we really need to base our actions off of, to a good extent, community standards and what's been done in the past. And we can analyze those according to reason. We can apply natural law to scrutinize those and see, okay, is this really morally right or morally wrong? But our first rattle out of the cage, so to speak, ethically and morally, we're on the safest ground, I think, when we're basing things off of traditions, morals that we've inherited, ethical ways, the ways we've been brought up. Descartes brings this out, and I think Descartes brings this out, very well in his methods, in his writings on the methods for inquiry. He says, while you're going through this radical process of trying to discern what is true, there are some rules you should follow. And first and foremost is, follow the ways of your countrymen. Don't doubt the ways that have been done in the past. Don't buck the system as you're trying to figure things out. And I think that's very good moral advice and ethical advice, because you're exactly right. Reason can go wrong. Reason does go wild. And so you have to have your main set, I think, of ethical beliefs be something that's more or less tried and true through human practice. That's a pragmatic approach to ethics, and I think there's a lot to be said for it, even though it gets dismissed out of hand pretty quickly, particularly in Western democratic, rationalist, modernist America.
Yeah, I think at the time he's writing, and maybe for the audience he has in mind, there's merit to that. I would say, though, that's highly problematic in today's setting, because there are entire nations engulfed in evil systems, like China is engulfed in atheistic communism. It's not a good idea to just to encourage people or instruct them to just simply accept the evils of their system, and rather than find ways
in his defense, he's saying, while you're thinking it through, while you're looking at the evidence, while you're weighing out whether this is evil or not, he's not saying don't question, but he's saying while you're questioning, don't let reason go wild, as Newman was.
I just don't know that he has in mind, in view, because of where he's at on the timeline and what would have been knowable to him at that time, that he could possibly have imagined some of the evil systems that have emerged, like communism, National Socialism, and some others.
Right.
I just don't think he doesn't have in view things like evil empires like we have the way that we have now.
Right, right. Because Descartes and Kant both lived before Nietzsche. And Nietzsche is sort of...
Right. Nietzsche is the intellectual fuel for a lot of that stuff, I think.
Right, right.
And he could be helpful, but he's also... I mean, he's very helpful to understand a lot of stuff that's going on, but...
Right. And, that brings us to Alistair MacIntyre. And Alistair MacIntyre picked on both you and me in this discussion. And he said, both attempts to base morality on natural law or some sort of reason-based, natural, divine-inspired law, and all the systems that we're trying to base morality off of some conception of pure reason, like Kant's deontology, they both ultimately failed. And we wound up in a situation where today ethical discourse breaks down into might makes right. And so, you have different factions trying to assert what is right based upon the power that they have in society and trying to gain societal power to, kind of force their ethical utterances on other people. So that's kind of where MacIntyre starts for. All these efforts to base morality and ethics off of some form of reason have failed. And so he's actually trying to call us back to a non-universal set of virtue ethics.
Yeah, and tradition. So I agree with your statement around in a limited sense, that it is super important. Culture and our traditions, our customs have an incredible, they are incredibly powerful in terms of how we're formed into individuals and into communities. The tricky part is, or difficult part is, you have, one is needs to establish the right kind of culture, right, and have the right kinds of customs and traditions that are carried through time, say through family life, and that I think, and that's the risk I think we're all kind of feeling right now, is that a lot of that is really at risk or up for grabs. That when we've lost, it seems that in the current setting, we've generally in our society lost the common commitment to the pursuit of the true, the good, and the beautiful. So what we're left with, as Nietzsche points out, you're left with this will to power, that what's left is a kind of tyranny, a tyranny expressed in assertion of power. And so now you have, since we've abandoned and don't believe in generally that there is an objective truth that we could pursue, or objective beauty or objective good that we can pursue, we're left then with simply to resolve our disagreements through power, and power struggles ultimately tend to escalate. And as they escalate, they then turn violent.
Right, right. I'm not quite so sanguine as MacIntyre is on the ability of modern man to access this idea of the true, the good, and the beautiful, and come up with standards. Come up with standards that are universal, that apply to all cultures, to where you can judge communist China and say, no, what they're doing is evil. Not just the opinion of the West, but universally, that's wrong. I think we still have access through traditions like natural law theory or deontology. I think they both arrive at the same place, to be perfectly honest. There's some metaphysical differences,
you
but
are
I think
profoundly mistaken, my friend.
But you know what? I think that involves a discussion of metaphysics, and maybe we'll tee up.
Let's do that for next time. Yeah,
yep, we'll tee up a conversation on metaphysics.
Yes,
and pit St. Thomas Aquinas against Kant.
Okay, I'll take Aquinas. you keep going back. I'm surprised. We're almost out of time. So you brought up one of the – it's been a long time, though, Mark, since we've talked about your unholy trinity, which is the Kant, Hegel, Heidegger trio. But we did spend a lot of time. Kant got a lot of FaceTime today.
I will acknowledge that two of those three are probably unholy, Hegel and Heidegger. But Kant, I'm not willing to throw him under the unholy bus quite yet.
His strange phenomenology, blah, blah, blah.
His strange phenomenology, blah, 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 that Pope John Paul the Great made his career off of.
Well, so. I don't know about that either. So, yes. His pneumonology, maybe that's more of what he did. But anyway, so we talked about ethics, talked about different systems. We didn't talk about divine command theory specifically. There's some other ethical systems, but it does. I hope what this conversation leads to is that a recognition that there's a lot of different worldviews, a lot of different spheres in which people are trying to make sense of the world and their lives. And the moral life is one that it's inescapable. We're always choosing and acting throughout our day. And as Catholics, though, at the end of the day, we have the blessing of the teachings of the Magisterium. Holy Mother Church is an infallible guide to and teacher of faith and morals. So we can always turn to Holy Mother Church to help us sort some of these things out.
And we have that at the end of the day, and this is the end of the show. So for Mark Tuttle, for Timothy O'Donnell, I'm Kent Blandford. Thanks for listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy. Until next time, be holy.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.